But he never swerved from his caravan route on the way to the court of the great Kublai Khan to make a side trip south to the mysterious country, where, he said, the people performed the most extraordinary marvels and sorceries by diabolic art. In his book he has a whole chapter on Tibet, not very flattering to Tibetans or their customs. Marco Polo must have collected his information second-hand from prejudiced Chinese. Just the same, some of Marco Polo's comments were true in his own 13th century and are still true today. Many travelers who have written of their Tibetan journeys have been only to its borders. And their books contain very little about the real Tibet. Comparatively few volumes in our Western libraries have authentic information about this strange land. And so unchanged has life been in Tibet down the centuries that the pictures and the text in accounts by the best of the old-timers are as up to date as if published last year. Even if Marco Polo missed out on Tibet, other early Europeans made the grade, some of them even to Lhasa. Our expedition was the last word in luxury compared to the conditions under which those old boys had to travel. Thinking of the exploits of those 17th and 18th century missionaries and listening to the steady patter of monsoon rains on our bungalow roof, we dropped off to sleep. We were confident that a relief crew would appear in 44 the morning, a swarm of willing coolies to help us on to Gangtok. Next morning came, with a break in the rains, but no coolies. So Dad and I decided to stroll up the road to get a close-up of the slide and figure out what our chances were. Maybe, Dad said, we'll meet a relief party on the other side, or at least be able to round up enough coolies to move our gear across. It was a sunny, blazing hot morning, and we soon stripped down to our shorts. Without much difficulty we climbed the wall of rock and jungle debris in order to take some pictures and survey the situation. As we clambered on we were alarmed at the number of small stones that were still coming down. Halfway across, we ducked for protection behind a large boulder just in time to avoid a shower of rocks which boomed overhead and bounded down the mountain. Phew, Dad said, mopping his brow. I'm beginning to wonder if we'll ever see Lhasa. In all our years in the mountains of America we had never encountered landslides the size of this. Obviously we were not in a healthy spot. But since we were halfway over we hustled to the other side of the slide. There we met some of the coolies who had been sent to help us. From them we learned that we were the first to cross the slide. For weeks afterwards traffic had to detour several miles over the top of the mountain as all loads were transferred to coolies and carried over a jungle track. That night, in Gangtok, we met two other incoming travelers, a Bhutanese prince and his sister. They had been obliged to climb the mountain to get around the avalanche. Even 2 months later, when we were on our way back from Lhasa, the road was still blocked. However, hundreds of coolies and engineers from Bengal with bulldozers had been at work and, riding in a jeep, we were the first to get through. Leaving the coolies behind to bring up the gear, we made 45, the final 18 miles to Gangtok by jeep. It began to drizzle and grew colder as we climbed to the 6,000-foot level, where the Sikkimese capital is located. Shivering in our khaki shorts, we arrived at the mountaintop home of Harishwar Dial, the Indian political officer. Although we were greeted warmly by Mr. Dial and his wife, our gracious hosts, during our brief stay there, they took one look at our abbreviated costumes and hurriedly supplied us with shirts and coats. They were too polite to express their amazement, but we knew they were thinking what strange people Americans are. Mr. Dial had good news for us. Our final clearance for entrance into Tibet had been received. It read in part, with reference to Mr. Lowell Thomas, United States National, and his son, although the Tibetan government does not usually allow foreign visitors to come to Lhasa in view of friendly relations between the Tibetan government and the government of the USA, they have granted permission for these two to enter the country. It was signed for the Dalai Lama by Tsepan Shekabpa, the man who headed the first Tibetan trade mission to the United States, in the summer of 1948. We were to meet him later in Lhasa. With its terraced rice fields and its polyglot population, Gangtok is a colorful town. In spite of its reputation as the tiniest capital in the world, It is one of the most important trade centers on the southern side of the Himalayas. Several caravan routes cross at Gangtok. Its marketplace is a kaleidoscope of races and costumes. And many tongues are spoken by the Tibetans, Sikkimese, Lepchas, Indians, Sherpas, and Bhutanese who load and unload their pack trains. Here we met Rinzing Dor, the swarthy Sikkimese who, for a fat fee and 10% of the salaries of all persons we hired, organized our caravan for us. A short, fat, jolly fellow with a pigtail wound atop his head, Dor reminded us of Chopsticks, the scheming but good-natured Chinese in the comic strip Terry and the Pirates. Always polite and 46, Harish Wardile, ICS, and his wife were our hosts at Gangtok. As the Indian political officer in Sikkim, Mr. Dial is in charge of India-Tibet affairs. He gave us the good news of our final clearance for entry to Tibet. 47, bowing, Rinzing Dor proved to be a shrewd operator. Outfitting pack trains was his specialty. If we found anything puzzling in his accounts, Dor wasn't embarrassed. He would merely grin and shrug. If mistake, just subtract. In addition to 6 baggage-carrying coolies, 9 pack mules and 4 riding ponies, Dor also arranged to hire the rest of the working members of our party. He secured our Sherpa, or headbearer, a Lepcha named Lajur, an invaluable man who could do a little of everything, and 2 Sikkimese Tibetans, Tsuwong Norbu, a first-rate cook, and Tsuwong Namjil, to fill the vital role of interpreter. Tales of Tibetan travelers are full of the woes that befall those who are unlucky in the servants they hire. But we drew top-flight men for our companions. Both the cook and the Sherpa flaunted wartime United States Army field jackets, GI shoes and those knitted caps our troops used to wear under their battle helmets. All through Asia, even in far-off Tibet, you find our surplus army stuff. Even in regions where no GI ever penetrated, one runs into startling reminders of World War II. In the hinterlands and backwaters, people often wear fantastic combinations of their own colorful and attractive costumes with our leftover military outfits. As for us, on our way through the monsoon belt in the Himalayas, we added to the confusion by wearing rubberized United States Navy storm suits. During our 3 days in Gangtok, we spent hours in the Dial courtyard, rearranging supplies and rebuilding the wooden boxes that were made for us in Calcutta. It turned out that they were too big. Each pack animal carries a double load on the trail. And if your boxes are oversized, your mule may bang against a mountain wall and go spinning off the narrow trail into canyons thousands of feet below. At Gangtok, also, we made a batch of recordings with our portable battery-driven recorder. This handy gadget weighs about 10 pounds, including batteries, tubes and tiny wrist 48. Our caravan is loaded in the backyard of the Indian residency at Gangtok, as we prepare to journey into the mountains of Sikkim on the first leg of the long trail that is to lead us to the Dalai Lama's holy city. 49. Microphone. Both of us put it to daily use, and it never once failed us throughout the trip. Our spools of recorded tape were rushed across the world to New York and presented as part of Dad's radio news program, the first unspot broadcasts that had ever been made from the land of the Lamas. Finally, we were ready. The Sherpa, with consideration for healthy appetites, had bought us a slew of tiny tomatoes, potatoes, string beans, eggs and 24 loaves of bread. The pack animals, with bells tinkling from their necks, and the coolies, the 2 Thomases and the rest of the little expedition were set to go. We were off at last on the long caravan journey to the holy city. 5. Over the Himalayan barrier before we moved on from Gangtok and the Hus Sea, Biteable Dials, the Indian political officer gave us some useful instructions. Keep in mind that you'll find only a few towns and villages along the way, he said. You must reach one of these each afternoon. The rest of the time you'll be riding through bleak, empty land. And it's rough going. Every other day or so you'll have to hire a fresh outfit of pack animals. From Gangtok to the Tibetan capital is usually a trip of 20 days. In our eagerness to reach Lhasa, We expected to speed things up and trim 5 or 6 days off the schedule. But we reckoned without the mules. No one can drive a mule faster than the critter is willing to move. Besides, the trek to Lhasa is slow and perilous going, over a narrow, twisting, ever-climbing route that often is carved from the perpendicular walls of deep gorges. And the cold, knife-like winds that continually lash the high Tibetan plateau do not make for rapid progress, nor does the rarefied 51 atmosphere of high altitude. We soon learned that 15 miles a day was a good average for a mule caravan crossing the Himalayas and in Tibet. On the morning of August 5th we hit the trail on the 300-mile jaunt, first through the rain-soaked forest of Sikkim, then over the towering Himalayas and finally across the wind-swept Tibetan tableland. There are few trade routes on this globe which have been used as long and as continuously as man has traveled the high road to Lhasa. Those accustomed to four-lane express highways would be hard to convince that the narrow track we were about to follow is one of Tibet's main trade links with the outside world. Stretching back into the dim centuries, caravans have plodded slowly over this skyline route, bound for India with wool, musk and yak tails. And, winding painfully over the mountains, the traders travel the same route in the same way today. Our 9-pack mules and a half dozen Sikkimese coolies had started on a few minutes ahead of us, and now from a little distance up the trail echoed the cries of the mule drivers and the dull clank-clank of mule bells. As we entered the bamboo forest and peered through the drenching monsoon rains into the deep canyon, the whole adventure seemed like a dream. Siwong Namjil, our interpreter, smiled and said, "Kale Pay." "What does that mean?" I asked. "It's the traditional Tibetan farewell when a caravan sets out to go over the Himalayas," he replied. "It means go slowly, if you hope to return." Interpreter Siwong, riding alongside, told us he had been born in Yatung, Tibet, but that his family had moved to Gangtok when he was young. Consequently, he had seen little of his native land. This was to be his first visit to Lhasa. Still in his early 20s, Siwong had just completed several years of agricultural study at an American missionary college 52, in Allahabad, India, and used our language with some facility. To join up with us he had to do some fast talking with the political officer, because the government had sponsored his education and now expected him to work for Sikkim as an agricultural specialist. As it turned out, we were most fortunate to have his services, for our two servants Norbu, the cook, and Ledger, our head bearer, while both fine fellows and unrivaled in their own jobs, could speak few words of English, and interpreting from English to Tibetan and back again was of constant importance to us. The monsoon rains poured down incessantly as we ambled up the stony trail. Clouds of steam rose from the bamboo jungle and at times made it impossible to see from one end of our procession to the other. These Himalayan foothills have an annual rainfall of 250 inches, second only to the rains of the hills of nearby Assam in volume. So much of that total was empty donors that we were drenched, despite our rubberized naval storm outfits. What a contrast between the south and the north side of that Himalayan wall. Jungle on one side, barren mountains and bleak plateau on the other, all because those water-laden clouds, rolling across India from the Bay of Bengal, strike the 5 mile high Himalayas and drop most of their moisture on Sikkim. Since few rain clouds drift beyond the Great Divide, Tibet has to manage with an average annual rainfall of about 12 inches. A labyrinth of bamboo and creepers rose straight up over our heads on one side of the narrow trail, on the other side was a sheer drop of thousands of feet. There were many signs of small avalanches, touched off by the tropical downpour. "T can't help thinking," I said, "what might happen if a landslide like the one we met back in the Tista Valley suddenly caught us here?" "Let's talk about a more pleasant subject," my father suggested. "A more immediate cause for worry was the leeches, tiny bloodsuckers, thin as horsehairs and about an inch long. Smelling or sensing the presence of our caravan, they would drop on us from the foliage above, and then if we were not quick to flick them off, loop to an opening in our boots or rain suits. Dad and I were able to keep these pests from fastening to the skin, but our poor coolies were less fortunate and their bare legs bled from leech bites. The mules, too, sneezed miserably with leeches in their nostrils. 10 miles of stiff climbing brought us to our first dak bungalow, at Karpunan. Originally built by the British, the dak bungalows of Sikkim are now maintained by the government of India as shelters for travelers. The one at Karpunan is perched in a small clearing near the edge of a gorge at an elevation of 10,000 feet. How pleasant to stretch out before a crackling log fire and dry our dripping clothes. The next day our caravan swung around some of the higher mountains of Sikkim, over one of the dizziest mountain trails I had ever seen. We looked down into deep chasms, as we rode the ribbon-like trail, too close for comfort to the giddy precipices. Dad's mule persisted in picking her way along the outer edge of the trail, usually within inches of the abyss. His natural impulse was to lean in, an action highly disapproved by the mule and not making her more sure-footed. My own mount had an exasperating way of stopping on the edge of nearly every precipice to reach over for a nibble at some succulent plant. Anyone who thinks he can make mules behave should go to the Himalayas and try his technique on those Sikkimese and Tibetan hardtails. After another 10 miles of slow going and steady climbing, to 12,600 feet, we reached the dak bungalow just above Lake Chehuekam, dark sheet of water hemmed in by steep slopes covered with rhododendron. We got off our mules and walked most of the way to Chehu, partly because we felt a little safer on our feet than my father recording a broadcast by candlelight in a dak bungalow. We made a point of preparing a Fivato 10-minute recording each evening. One day Dad would do the job, the next evening it would be my turn. 55, riding along the edge of canyon walls and partly because walking acclimates one more quickly to high altitudes. All day we were gradually climbing out of the bamboo forest, with its steam and leeches, and into terrain similar to that of the American Rockies, with a smattering of pines. We picked wild strawberries from the rocky cliffs, strawberries 2 and 3 times the size of American varieties but purple instead of red, and not nearly as sweet. Frequently we stopped to admire the flowers, the beardless purple iris, flat yellow poppies, 2 inches in diameter, bell-shaped primulas, of which there are some 60 varieties. The mountains of Sikkim at this season were covered with thousands of different flowers, including more than 350 varieties of wild orchids and endless varieties of rhododendron. In the Himalayas, incidentally, the rhododendron is a tree, not a bush. Many of these trees grow to a height of 30 and 40 feet, with trunks 4 feet thick. At the miniature end of the scale is the fascinating scarlet dwarf rhododendron. Here and there we came upon a rather sinister flower, the blue Himalayan monkshood. Into the essence brewed from this poisonous plant, the Sikkimese and Bhutanese, who used to war with each other, would dip their arrows and spears, so that a mere scratch from a weapon caused death. Finally, because so many of their people were related, the Sikkimese and Bhutanese agreed not to use the poison any longer. Toward the end of this second day's march, we passed acres of yellow daisies that gave off a strange pungent odor. Encountering a Sikkimese on the trail, we were told that any headaches we might have and we had them came not from the altitude but from those daisies. Along the trail danced the loveliest flowers I have ever seen, endless carpets of them, as if nature had lavishly bestowed the ultimate in her adornment of the Himalayas. We were especially enchanted with the alpine flowers of Incredi 56. The principal caravan route through the Himalayas into Tibet is narrow and stony. Down this trail for countless centuries have come, just as shown here, Tibetan caravans carrying wool, yak tails and musk to India. 57. Variety and shades of color which bordered the trail, some clinging to moss-covered rocks, others glistening like gems on the stumps of dead trees. This Himalayan country would be a paradise for a crack botanist. Too bad we don't know more about plants, I said, a bit wistfully. Why, most of these flowers we've never met up with before. Years ago I knew a remarkable Englishman, Father put in, a chap who devoted his life to hunting orchids and other new species in the Himalayas Kingdom ward. I wish he were with us. Dad went on to tell me more about Captain Kingdom ward. He must be in his middle 60s now, and as far as Dad knows, still makes his headquarters in Calcutta and spends most of his time collecting plant specimens and seeds in the wildest and most inaccessible regions of the Himalayas. In the beginning he had no intention of being a plant collector. Upon graduating from Cambridge, he sailed to Shanghai to teach school. But the call of the wild must have got him when an invitation came from England to collect plants on the Tibetan border of Yunnan. Actually he had studied botany and been brought up on it, for his father Harry Marshall Ward had been a distinguished professor of botany at Cambridge University. That was about 1910, Dad explained, when Kingdon Ward was in his early 20s. He spent 2 years in the mountains of western China and in southeastern Tibet. From the wooded highlands east of Lhasa he brought back the famous blue poppy. His first book, about that trip, was called The Land of the Blue Poppy, a marvelous account of his experiences as a naturalist and of the aboriginal tribes in mountain country rarely, if ever, visited by Westerners. From that time on, Kingdon Ward's career was cut out for him. He was to be a plant hunter in Asia. He told me once that plant hunting is a serious business. 58 L.T. Senior, leading our caravan through the mountains of Sikkim on the climb to Nathula, the pass on the Tibetan frontier, this is one of those rare moments of the whole Sikkim journey when it wasn't training. 59, and can be learned only by actual experience, Dad said. A plant collector working in a mountainous country in search of alpines has to spend 6 or 7 months in the area selected, from April, when the plants start flowering in the valleys, to November, when the seeds ripen. Over the years Kingdon Ward has roamed the Himalayas in search of plants and has been several times to western China and southeastern Tibet, to Assam and the northeast frontier of Burma. He has never gone as far afield as Thailand and Indochina. Out of these many explorations he has created at least a dozen books. Flower lovers may not know that he is responsible for some of the most attractive and unusual flowers now growing in English and American gardens and greenhouses. He has discovered many new varieties of Himalayan and other Asiatic plants, which in the conventional Latin classification of botanists are tagged with his name, Wardit. Did he ever get to Lhasa? I asked. Not as far as I know, Dad replied. But Kingdon Ward was always more interested in living plants than in living gods. Months later, as I sit at home writing about Kingdon Ward, a press dispatch has come from India saying that he and his wife are missing in the Himalayas of Tibet and Assam, where a stupendous cataclysm of nature has been taking place. For more than a week, the dispatch says, there have been violent earthquakes in those mountains, and scientists believe that on the roof of the world the face of the earth is being changed. It is not known what has happened to the Kingdon Wards. The force of the upheaval has been such that one of the world's major rivers has been thrown from its course. The Brahmaputra, called Tsangpo in Tibet, has been hurled into an ancient riverbed, one that it poured through thousands of years ago. 60. Imagine the floods when a river as big as the Mississippi suddenly alters its course. Sketchy reports from New Delhi state that after a great loss of life 10,000 people are marooned by floods along the wild mountain borders of Assam and Tibet, where the Brahmaputra turns south and begins its prodigious plunge from 12,000 feet to sea level and the Bay of Bengal. Some 200 villages have been inundated and their inhabitants forced to take to the treetops to await rescue. The Indian government has sent a large fleet of shallow draft boats to navigate the floodwaters and save lives. There are grim descriptions of the carcasses of thousands of wild animals, tigers, elephants, and the horned rhino, all overwhelmed by the deluge. The Tibetan sky at night is pictured as having a glow of scarlet. The river waters have turned a sulfury green, like something out of the Inferno. Scientists declare that giant Himalayan peaks, which have slept for thousands of years, are bursting forth in volcanic fury. Geologists believe the quakes will continue for years. They refer to the earthquake of 1897, the worst in modern history, when the shocks in the Himalayas lasted for 10 years. This present cataclysm may be just as bad. A geologist in India points out that the Earth's crust has been in motion out there. The Himalayas have grown taller in the past couple of hundred years. Mount Everest, the world's tallest, when calculated some 30 years ago, measured 29,002 feet. Recently Everest measured 29,200 feet, nearly 200 feet higher. So, based on that, the supposition is that during the present quakes the Himalayas are being thrust up. If Kingdon Ward and his wife survive this display of nature's fury, and I have a feeling that they will, what a story they will have to tell the world. At Chennai that evening, over a hearty dinner of roast beef, beans and potatoes, we had an interesting conversation with the Maharaj Kumar of Sikkim, the son of the present Maharaja and next in line to be ruler of that Himalayan state. He happened to drop in at the Chennai bungalow while on a fishing trip. The young Sikkimese prince, who speaks flawless English after 7 years at a British school in Simla for sons of Maharajas, pointed out to us that the blaze on the hearth warming our backs was a rhododendron fire. For heating and cooking, rhododendron is preferred to other kinds of tropical forest timber because it produces greater heat and, most important in a land with a yearly rainfall of from 200 to 250 inches a year, it will burn even when wet. The Maharaj Kumar and his father, he told us, have been trying to stop their people from cutting down the rhododendron, as a safeguard against denudation. But they have not had much cooperation. A year ago a forest ranger was sent to the Chennai region on the trail of poachers who were cutting down rhododendron trees. He caught two of them and was bringing them in for punishment, but he never made it. They pushed him off a precipice, one that we had crossed that afternoon. It was still raining when we got up next morning, and the beautiful scenic view from Chennai was completely shut off. We doggedly set forth through the monsoon downpours. The higher we climbed, the colder it became. For 3 hours our party wound its way up the mountain. Our mules slipped on the wet stones and slithered through the mud. We passed a Buddhist prayer wheel run by water power. It was a barrel ornamented with religious symbols and stuffed with prayers written on cloth and paper. The barrel spun round and round in the rushing stream. With each revolution, it is believed, the prayers are transmitted to Buddha and to the higher gods of the Tibetan spiritual realm. We were on our way to the border between India and Tibet at Nathula. La is the Tibetan word for pass. The last few miles before the pass were tedious going, and the rain was cold. To warm up, we hiked the final mile, cutting 62, across the trail straight up over moss-carpeted rocks through the rhododendron. Nathula, at 14,800 feet, was the highest elevation we had reached as yet. There we encountered none of the military and customs barriers usually found at a frontier. Three bushy-tailed wild yaks, peering down at us suspiciously from a high ledge before bolting, were the only living things we saw on the Tibet-India border. Where the trail leveled off and headed into the forbidden land, we passed under a yak hair rope fastened to two boulders. From that cord hung hundreds of cloth prayer flags, waving vigorously in the strong wind, each wave carrying the prayers to heavenly headquarters much the same as the revolutions of the water-powered prayer barrel. These flags are essentially good luck talismans, invoking the aid of such lamaistic deities as the god of wisdom, the protector against accident and illness, and the bestower of long life. Frequently the person making the offering has his name or year of birth inscribed on the flag. And always it carries the mystic syllables which ring constantly from one end of Tibet to the other, Om Mani Padme Hum. Hail to the jewel in the lotus. As we crossed the border, we doffed our hats and bowed in accordance with the Tibetan custom. Then, shouting and throwing rocks to frighten away evil spirits, we added our bit to a cairn which had grown to a height of 30 feet as a result of the stone offerings of previous passers-by. Some of the Buddhists in our working party devoutly kept repeating their chant, Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum, to drive away the demons, who are believed to make their home on Nathula, as on all mountain passes. Lashed by the driving rain, we were too cold to linger at Nathil and kept moving on foot down over some washouts into the enormous Upper Chumbi Valley. On the wall to our right and high above, we saw a few patches of snow, from which trickled a ribbon of water that grew larger and larger as it plunged on through the valley. Looking at our maps, we could see that this tiny stream was one of the beginnings of one of the world's mightiest rivers, the Brahmaputra.